this week on the Back Table Podcast.
I'd just like to put a push for either making a commitment to a change in one surgery. We made a change in the way we conducted slings and observing how we were carrying out our sling cases. That was my first project. And by constantly educating those that were in our operating room and educating and talking about and pointing out the trash, so many more people learned from just us doing it with this case every time. And they took it to other services. And then we did this again with our cystoscopy cases. We minimized the equipment that we were using. So committing, you're thinking, what can I do? Just start small, low-hanging fruit, minimize something in your own operating room, and do it every time. And you may be pleasantly surprised by what other people see you doing and that they're going to start doing that elsewhere. That is how we can make an impact.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Back Table OBGYN podcast, your source for all things obstetrics and gynecology. You can find all previous episodes of our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on backtable.com.
It's Amy Park, and it's my great pleasure to host another episode of our podcast, Backtable OBGYN, a physician-facing podcast on the issues facing OBGYNs today and the greater community. It is my great pleasure to have some dear colleagues, influencers, leaders in this space, Drs. Jane Van Dis and Dr. Alexandric Melnick, also known as Allie. Welcome, welcome. And I'm just going to turn it over to you guys to give us a little intro and insight into yourselves. Jane, why don't you go first?
Amy, thanks so much for having me. And Allie, I'm really excited. Obviously, we're super passionate about this topic. I'm actually an assistant professor at the University of Rochester. And I've been reading on the climate crisis really since my twins were born in 2008, but more seriously over the last few years. I actually am a climate migrant. I moved to the University of Rochester from Los Angeles, where there were a lot of fires, there was a lot of heat, drought, and it was an urban place that didn't make me feel very safe in terms of what's going to happen in the years to come with the climate crisis. So I moved to a place near the Great Lakes, and now I'm really happy to be publishing on this topic, working with Allie at OBGYNs for a Sustainable Future, and excited to talk to you tonight.
And just a little plug about Jane. I was at the University of Rochester Medical School, and I'm actually from California, and I can attest that it's a lot of connections there. Also taught at ACOG in a course together. I think there's a lot of interest in this topic. And yeah, the climate crisis is real in California between the earthquakes, which always have been there, but the fires and the atmospheric rivers and the flooding and the mudslides and all the things. There's quite a lot going on there. Well, Allie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, thank you so much for having us tonight. I echo Jane's excitement and sentiment. I am on staff with you at your gynecology at Cleveland Clinic, and I got involved in this topic during my fellowship where honestly, I was doing a literature review on a different topic, and I stumbled upon a really, really exciting piece looking at the carbon footprint of hysterectomies, which hit home. And it was fascinating to me and appalling how much waste we were producing in the operating room and this invisible footprint that I had never thought about with the production of all of the materials that we use and how much gets thrown away. And I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but really from stumbling upon this literature, it really opened the door to me. And from then, I did a couple of research projects. I started a Greening the Urogynecology Operating Room initiative and fellowship. And through that work, I applied for this award, which is for CleanMed, a really great conference that's held every year that brings together physicians, building engineers, folks from Central Sterilization and Linens, all of these different groups of people who care about greening medicine, essentially. And I, again, opened the door to me, and it really opened my eyes into this field. And from then, I continued to do some work and write, and Jane and I hooked up, and we created OBGYNs for a Sustainable Future, which you can reach us at obg4sf.org, shameless plug, where we have a website and we put on webinars that is specific to OBGYN and greening our field. And since I've graduated fellowship several months ago and started at the Cleveland Clinic with Amy, I've been onboarding and trying to get some new projects off the ground here. And I'm excited to share them all in due time, I'll say.
I think that this topic and on all your efforts in this sphere is more timely than ever. Last year, 2023, was one of the hottest, I think the hottest year on record. And it just felt like there was crisis after crisis, heat, rain, flooding, all the things. So can you tell us what's happening today in terms of climate change? Like, what's going on?
I can kind of speak to that. I follow these scientists every day. I'm somewhat addicted to the conversations that are going on. And the really hard part for people to understand, and I actually gave grand rounds on Friday at Southview down on Long Island, the Department of OBGYN there. And I've said, if there was a way that I could make every American understand what 6 standard deviations from the mean means, because that's how far off of normal our seas are right now. So as most people know, the seas have absorbed the majority of our carbon emissions since the Industrial Revolution. I read Bill McKibben said, I think it was back in 2018, that our land surface temperature, if the seas had not absorbed all of that excess CO2 and methane, would be 97 degrees Fahrenheit hotter on land. So obviously completely uninhabitable for almost all forms of life. So the idea is then that all of that energy has now gone into the oceans, which obviously comprise the majority of the surface area on the Earth. Having said that, the oceans are sort of, I feel like the oceans are now like talking back, right? Because for them to be 6 standard deviations from the mean hotter than they normally would be means, I think, that we're in for a lot of rapid change. Now, there's a lot of debate going on as to whether or not we're in an accelerated period, which is to say we're not going in a linear fashion as the models had predicted, that there's an aberration and an acceleration of heating and change. And you'll see the climate scientists debate that. But I've actually read a couple of papers now that seem pretty convincing that we are in an accelerated phase. And so what that means is that kind of like all the models are a little bit off, right? And so for instance, when we saw the COP and we saw people talking about 1.5 degrees Celsius as like, hey, we better not cross that. Well, we crossed it in 2023, right? I believe we're at 1.78 degrees C above normal, above pre-industrial 1850 means. And so I guess I feel like I still see in print a lot that people say, well, if we can stay under 1.5, and it's like, well, people, I'm not sure that we're ever going to see 1.5 again. We are in an El Nino, and so that has affected a lot of the heat and a lot of the aberrations that we're seeing. Having said that, some of the scientists are saying we're past 1.5, and we are going to pass 2 by 2030. And that's a very different world than the one we're living in now, because at 2C, that's when we start to see some of the tipping points kick in, where we have accelerated loss of sea ice, so accelerated sea level rise. Right now, you hear people talk about sea level rise, and they'll be like, oh, it's just a couple of centimeters a year. But if you talk to the people in Portland, Maine over the weekend, where there was 14 feet above the normal sea level due to the high tide plus the storm, they're absolutely saying that this is a new normal. So, Amy, I can't actually answer your question, because the fact is that we've left the Goldilocks zone, right? We've left the zone that humans have evolved in over the last tens of thousands of years. And so we are in a new normal, and we should expect that we are going to see continued aberrations like the one that we saw this week, where the weakness of the polar vortex has allowed Arctic air to go down to Dallas, so that they had like, it was 14 degrees in Dallas yesterday. So that's a new normal. These atmospheric rivers and these hurricanes that sort of circle and stay in the same place like they did, Hurricane Harvey did. Every single possible weather event, I feel like, is seen at a greater degree, a greater proportion. So the proportionality has absolutely changed. And so we'll see. I mean, like I said, it's a new normal, and we're never going back.
I know, it's interesting, because you alluded to two things earlier in your intro that I think about all the time. Is my older son was also born in 2008. And there's a lot of youth these days who are not wanting to have children because they don't want to bring their children into the environmental impact of having kids, bringing them into this environment. It's like definitely become more of a thing. The other thing I was thinking of is, I just remember Cleveland Magazine had this article from I think it was like sometime in the spring or summer of last year. And it was like, is climate safe for climate refugees like yourself? Yeah. So to your point, I mean, a Great Lakes kind of town and inland. And yes, of course, we have some pretty extreme weather, but not as extreme and dangerous as the wildfires, et cetera, as in California.
Well, and you have water, and that's going to be a resource that's going to be in high, high demand. The New York Times has done some incredible reporting on the nation's aquifers and what a dangerous state that they are in. And actually, what's so fascinating is actually the satellites are taking photographs using magnetic imaging to determine how much water is in U.S. aquifers. And that, to me, that technology obviously is just so fascinating that you could take a picture from the sky and see underneath the rock and the earth. But the fact of the matter is that there are places like Arizona, like the Southwest, that, you know, are looking at a future where water will be the most valuable resource.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like there's subdivisions in Phoenix that are, they can't even build out anymore because they're not allotted any water. So you're right.
Yeah. I mean, all of this is really, really making me remember all of those pictures of the Colorado River this summer, which is exactly what we're talking about. And I think that not everybody knows that so much of the Southwest and the West rely on like snow-capped mountains and all of that snow that'll then melt and go into these rivers and help to give us municipal water and energy, et cetera. But you're right. I mean, it's like those are real things that we'll be fearing in the next several years. And it's scary.
It's absolutely scary. Well, how does climate change impact health and like specifically women's health and reproductive outcomes?
Yeah, I'll take that. And then maybe Allie wants to do the women's health. I'll do the maternal. It's absolutely profound, the manners by which the climate crisis is impacting reproductive health. I'll start with heat. So as you might guess, women who live in areas that are hotter, where, for instance, even a wet bulb temperature is higher, we saw this in data coming out of Pakistan, they're more likely to experience preterm births, low birth weight, and even stillbirth. And then heat also affects fertility rates as well. We know that heat affects both the female reproductive system and the male reproductive system. Interestingly enough, on the OBGYNs for Sustainable Future, OBG, the number 4SF.org, we had Blair Wiley from Columbia University, and she was talking with us about the fact that mosquitoes are more attracted to pregnant women. They off-gas more CO2, and they have a higher basal metabolic temperature. And so if you were to put a bunch of people in a room with mosquitoes, the mosquitoes would be more attracted to, they're more likely to bite a pregnant woman. And so as we're seeing in the, especially in the U.S. Southeast, we're seeing more rates of malaria, which was a disease that really didn't come to the U.S. shores very often, especially not where the person contacted it in the U.S., right? And then dengue too. Dengue is moving northward as well. And then the problem we see too is that as the winters get less cold, obviously, our recent cold snap notwithstanding, the tick seasons are longer, and so increased risks for Lyme disease as well. So these infectious diseases do put pregnant women at increased risk. There was a great study in the AJOG, in the Gray Journal, that looked at how women who were pregnant during Hurricane Harvey, what their pregnancy outcomes were like. And what they found was is that since Houston, which is where they did the study, since Houston has 42% of all U.S. petrochemicals are manufactured or refined in Houston, as that hurricane sat and caused leakage of some of these chemicals into the water tables, those petrochemicals then had effects on those women's pregnancies in a linear fashion, such that the closer she lived while she was pregnant to a petrochemical manufacturing site, the more likely she was to have water that was contaminated. And then the more likely she was likely to have increased morbidity for her pregnancy. I believe it went up 20%, 27%. And then for fetal outcomes, neonatal morbidity went up like close to 50% for those women who were in close proximity to that contaminated water. So flooding impacts pregnant women. And then wildfires also increase the risk of preterm birth and low birth weight. Same with fossil fuel air pollution. Really what we're looking at are particles 2.5 micrometers or less These are exacerbating people who have asthma, but they're also affecting these pregnancies in profound, profound ways. In addition, studies showing that people who fight our fires have increased risks of miscarriage and infertility. So lots and lots of ways. We've also, I want to say importantly, found studies showing that the closer you live to a major roadway, say a freeway or highway, the increased risk for infertility, say if you're going through an IVF cycle, you will be less likely to conceive the closer you live to a roadway. Again, that's an air pollution correlation. So lots and lots of ways that these external, I call them external impacts from fossil fuels and climate crisis affecting the reproductive body. Maybe later we can talk in this podcast about how fossil fuels are getting into our body.
Oh, yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. The other thing that I did want to bring up when you were talking was, I was just thinking about these articles that I've been reading about how we talked about climate refugees and we're like, okay, LA to Rochester, but like, how about we're looking at whole-scale displacement of people from the Tigris and Euphrates rivers? And like, they're used to be very fertile areas, and now it's just complete desert. Like, people cannot survive. I mean, they are literally moving and cannot scrabble living together. It's crazy. It's displacing multiple populations, island nations, etc. Allie, did you want to say anything else about the women's health in particular?
I will, but you actually just brought up something that I wanted to touch a little bit more about. So ACOG in 2016 put out a position statement on climate change and women's health. Then they restated it in 2020. But they basically said that climate change is an urgent women's health concern and a major public health challenge. We call on our national and international leaders to act to curb greenhouse gas emissions. And in this statement, they even said that the effects of climate change, food and water insecurity, civil conflicts, extreme weather events, all of these things that we've been talking about, spread of disease, put women in these affected regions at elevated risk of disease, malnutrition, sexual violence, poor mental health, lack of reproductive control, negative OB outcomes, and death. And so while we're talking about this, we're talking about it and having a conversation, but there's obviously a lot of literature on this subject, and ACOG has recognized it as well. We're happy to talk about all this so that more people can hear and learn how bad things really are. I hate to say it that way. But to touch a little bit more on just women in general, overall with extreme heat, you know, women who are most vulnerable, or I should say adults who are most vulnerable, are those greater than 65 years old and those with chronic illnesses, cardiopulmonary disease, and also very young children, especially under the age of 5. And so we've been having, you know, more heat waves and these have been lasting longer. But something that's interesting that I've learned in recent years is that in urban areas, this heat actually lasts for longer. It's called an urban heat island. And the reason why is in cities where many of our listeners are listening to us, there's more asphalt, there's more surface area that's going to absorb the heat, and there's less greenery and less ability for the heat to get back into the atmosphere. And so what happens is it's really hot during the day, and then at night, it doesn't get cooler. And that can persist for days and days. And so all of those people who are at higher risk and maybe don't have, especially those in red line districts who maybe don't have air conditioning or maybe don't have access to a center where they can go to cool for several hours, things like that, they're going to be more at risk of having heat related events because of that. And it's, you know, we can expect to see more of this in the coming years because of these extreme heat waves. That's something I definitely wanted to touch upon. But otherwise, I think that Jane said a lot of the literature that we know so far, you discussed it very nicely. And we have learned a lot, especially about the nanoparticles and the fine particulate matter. And with wildfires, one of the biggest things is that this fine particulate matter can last for weeks at a time, and it can get into our respiratory system. It can get into our bloodstream and go to other vital organs. And I think that this hit home for so many of us this summer when our skies were turning orange. We don't live anywhere near the wildfires of Canada, yet we couldn't go outside or it was orange. And I think for truly many Americans, it really hit home. And as negative as that experience was for a lot of us, I think it was an eye-opening experience that this is happening and we need to take steps to curb what we're doing.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because last summer I remember my brother who lives in San Francisco. I'm from California originally. He was like, "Welcome to my world. It's been like this for a long time." And Jane can attest to this. This has been Los Angeles. This has been California forever. And then these wildfires in Montreal, it was crazy. It was blanketing. I mean, I saw New York pictures. It looked like it was the dead of night when it was noon. It was crazy.
Right. Right. Like, that's not normal. That's not almost not how it's supposed to be.
Yeah. Yeah. And even before the pandemic, my brother had air, like a HEPA filter in his house, and had N95s because of the air quality being so bad. It's funny. It's the climate change really has prompted a lot of my personal friends to really move. I had a friend from who was working in the World Bank, and she left Delhi because her son's asthma was so bad there, had to move to DC. I had another friend of a friend who was living in New York City and moved out to California for the asthma. Ha ha, because now the air quality there is also bad. But yeah, a lot of people are suffering from it. I just wanted to pivot to something June had alluded to earlier regarding the stuff that's in the air, like the forever plastics and phthalates and those kind of things. Like, because we were talking about reproductive outcomes, and I just wanted to get into a little bit about like how are these are sort of man-made issues and changes that are affecting women's health as well. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like it really comes home when you realize that 12% of all global oil is made into plastic. And plastic, our society runs on it. There's so many things. Obviously, we as doctors use plastic all the time. Medical care wouldn't happen. How would we deliver blood? How would we draw a lab with a syringe? Everything around us in the medical field is plastic. So our society absolutely runs on it. But it is important to note that the fossil fuel producers recognized that plastic was a great place to continue to make investments and push technology back in the 70s. And this is when obviously they knew the impacts that their product was going to have on human health. Their own researchers, like Big Tobacco, knew that we were in for a world of hurt. Having said that, I wonder if you guys remember, I just had this like core memory unlocked the other day when I remembered that there were times when we'd go to a vending machine and the soda was in a bottle, was in a glass. And now, like, if you said that to a kid, they'd be like, what? I mean, yeah, you can see some sodas once in a while, some of the specialty sodas, especially in glass. But our whole society has pivoted to plastic. And what that has meant, unfortunately, is that that plastic is now polluting our bodies, such that the American Cancer Institute said our babies are being born pre-polluted. And so in my grand rounds, I have a slide dedicated to the fact that three studies came out in 2023, all of which showed that these placentas that had been tested were positive for microplastics. Overwhelmingly, this was polyvinyl chloride and PET, the plastic that you see in the plastic water bottles. So the plastics are crossing the placenta, but Amy, they're crossing the blood-brain barrier as nanoplastics too. Now we have studies showing that there is plastic basically in every organ in the body. And when plastics cross into the brain, they are being linked to dementia. When plastics cross into other parts of the body, they're linked to cancers and autoimmune problems. So the problem is that the plastic water bottle that you drink out of has 10,000 other chemicals in it that haven't been approved by, say, the FDA or the EPA. So there's a lot of exposure that we don't even know about. And then what happens, obviously, is that those plastics are breaking down. There was a study you guys probably saw published just this week showing that in 1 liter of water bottle, there were potentially 250,000 particles of nanoplastic. So nanoplastic basically is small enough to cross every barrier in our body. And it's interesting. I'm giving a talk at the library here in my town at the end of the month. So I really want to have some more practical information, less academic. And so I just started this book about plastic. And interestingly enough, tonight I just finished the chapter on what the author terms petroplankton. So this is plankton, which is a huge component of the ocean ecology and the ocean sea life. Plankton obviously are one of the backbones of all marine life. Well, the plankton are uploading all this plastic into their bodies. And so he was talking about how he doesn't refer to them as plankton. He refers to them as petroplankton. But the fact is that the phthalates are a key component of a lot of plastics. They make the plastics pliable. So all of the catheter tubing, all the blood bags, all the gloves that we use in medicine, those all have phthalates in them. And unfortunately, those phthalates have been associated with significant reproductive harm. So have been related to endocrine disruptions such as infertility, early puberty. There was a New York Times article this week saying, like, why is the age of puberty, why does it keep getting lower and lower? And I'm like, we know why. We know why. It's due to these phthalates. It's due to these plastics. And so it's affecting the birth weight of our babies. It's affecting whether our babies will be born with congenital anomalies. They did a study showing the feces of a newborn versus the feces of a grown adult. And the feces of the newborn had 20 times the concentration of plastics than the adult did. And that's due to the body surface area to volume ratio of the infant compared to the adult. And so to be sure, the American Cancer Institute is right. Our babies are being born pre-polluted. And the problem is that if you were to say, like, well, Jane, you know, what's the solution? And the solution is not to necessarily recycle the plastic, because the recycling process actually can continue to leach out into the environment as well. So the answer is that we don't have a solution right now. And that's a huge problem. There is increased cancers associated with exposure to these chemicals. And I guess I feel like we haven't reached like peak plastic yet. What do you think, Allie?
I mean, actually, I would say that part of the solution is that we stop making it. You know, we stop making it. We start, right? I mean, obviously, easier said than done. But we just need to cut back our use on it. And that's, we're laughing because that is so hard. We're up against so many barriers. And, you know, because it's so ubiquitous in our lives and in our workplace and in what we eat and drink out of, if you get takeout, you know, half of those containers are plastic, or there's some of these forever chemicals like PFAS, you know, they're going to coat the containers for the takeout food. That's what helps make them leak proof and waterproof. And that is getting ingested. So some of the reality is that we need to, well, number one, educate, which we're doing. We try and try as best as we can, but then we do need to minimize making and using plastic. That's not going to necessarily stop where we're at right now. And, you know, it's, these studies will only show us more and more what's in our bodies and what's happening. However, it is a place to start. And if it's okay, I'm going to pivot again a little bit just into some of medicine and how we see plastics in medicine. So one of the things is, so many people will say that, well, we have these stainless steel instruments, and but they're more infection risk than plastic, than this single-use stuff, because it's never been in another patient and it's never going to be used again. But that's not necessarily true for all products, and we can delve more into this a little bit later. But even in our own field, in the past several years, 5 to 10 years, there were some studies came out, there were some instruments that were contaminated. And instead of kind of fine-tuning these instruments that were being cleaned and washed, and it was maybe 25 cases or so, that's what was really kind of documented in the record. However, what happened is all these companies then, instead of fine-tuning and innovating so that these reusable devices weren't having infections, they instead went to disposable. And so now all these devices that we use, duodenoscopes, bronchoscopes, laryngoscopes, all the scopes, many of them can be totally disposable, which is just an example of how plastic is coming, you know, more and more into our field, and it's harder to get rid of that. When in medicine, the hard part that we're up against is the risk for infection. And that is, nobody wants an infection, but also we can't get to zero. It's just a part of life. It's a part of medicine. And we need to really start weighing in all parts of medicine, you know, OBGYN, the emergency room, internal medicine, you know, the ICU. We need to evaluate everywhere. Yes, this is preventing infection, but are we doing more than we need to, perhaps? Take a step back and become more minimalist with all the things that we're using, because there is so much waste. That's another topic, but so much of what we are using and opening is plastic, to bring it back to the plastics conversation. And we just really need to revisit and rethink that.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, to piggyback on what Ali was saying, you know, exactly, the data regarding plastic speculum, for instance, versus metal speculum, there's no data to show that the plastic speculum is any less likely to prevent infection so long as protocols for disinfection are followed with the stainless steel. And the stainless steel has 25%, one quarter of the carbon emissions in its life cycle than does the plastic. Not to mention, I didn't see this in the Gray Journal study, but like we use the lighted speculums at the University of Rochester, and those have two of those 25 CD25 button batteries in them. So for 30 seconds that we've used it in the vagina, we're now also throwing out, in addition to the plastic, two lithium batteries. So there's a lot of ways that we haven't looked at how our practices might be impacting the health, not only of our patients, but also our communities. Because that plastic, that lithium, that's all going to get buried in a community near where we live.
What is the impact of healthcare, generally speaking, on the environment and the climate? It seems like it's got a huge impact, but can you like put it in some numbers or in a way that I can really like put my mind around it?
Yeah, well, I mean, healthcare, U.S. healthcare contributes 10% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. So, and when you look at per capita U.S. healthcare versus healthcare delivery in other countries per capita, we are double, triple, quadruple other industrialized nations. So we are the largest user of single-use plastic. Healthcare is the largest industry use of single-use plastic in the world. And we use more plastic in the U.S. than the entire, in healthcare, than the entire country of the U.K. And then they just came out with this study published, I believe it was on Thursday, showing plastic chemicals were linked to spend of about $250 billion in U.S. healthcare costs in 2018. So we're paying for all of our plastic. We're paying for it in the health that we then have to treat, the healthcare problems that we then have to treat in our patients. So we really owe it to them to try and fix this.
Yeah, it's not just the greenhouse emissions, but it's all the other things, right? Like what other components of healthcare are contributing, do you think?
Well, the majority of the greenhouse gas emissions in healthcare are scope three. 80% of all U.S. greenhouse gas emissions in healthcare are scope three. So it's all the supply chain problems. But we tend to, let's face it, we have a for-profit healthcare system, and that's what's really different between us and other industrialized nations. So I would say if you were to take a doctor from Britain and France and Germany and Portugal and ask them if they know any of their reps, right? All the reps that come to the hospital to sell us stuff, I bet you they don't. There's a lot of capitalism in healthcare, and I think that that consumption translates into a lot of emissions as well.
Absolutely.
What does scope three mean?
Sure, I'll go ahead and explain that. So basically, the scopes divide the types of emissions from a system. It can be a healthcare system. It can be other types of systems. But basically, scope one is direct emissions. So for example, things like fossil fuels, our facilities, the anesthetic gases we use, the gas that goes into our fleet of vehicles that take people to and from parking lots or to and from offices to help carry equipment, et cetera. That's direct emissions into the environment. That can be, you know, many different types of greenhouse gases. And then scope two is indirect emissions from our electricity. So we can't necessarily change the grid that we're on. However, you can try and source your electricity from, you know, solar, hydro, et cetera. And then scope three, what Jane was mentioning, this is indirect emissions from the supply chain. So this is the devices themselves and the production costs that it took to make the devices. This is business services, inhalers. This is waste. Food and catering. This is transport for patients and staff to and from the hospital. If you're not really a fan of telemed, sometimes it can be great because it's saving both you and the patient potentially from getting to the hospital. And that sort of thing, medication. So scope three is really, really a big factor here. And to put it in perspective, when we look at global healthcare greenhouse gas emissions by the scopes, it makes up about 71% of the emissions from healthcare. Whereas the direct emissions that are coming from the fleet, from anesthetics, et cetera, is really 17%. And scope two, our electricity grid, is 12%. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal. And people come to Jane and I all the time saying, like, where do we start? What do we do? And it's part of it is doing an assessment in your own division, your department, your hospital of scope three, because that's going to be where we as individuals and, you know, departments on smaller scales can make a difference, because we know that that footprint is so large.
It's just so interesting to me about the supply chain stuff, because these are all things that you really need to get into the nitty gritty. And having interacted with you guys, like, I'm just amazed at how much you really have to get into environmental services, into contracting, into food service. Like, can you guys tell me about the work that you're doing as your local leaders and just doing a lot of this work? Because I think, but like in discrete bites, like I don't want it to sound overwhelming, but I just want to hear kind of what you've been involved in and what you've had to do in your own institutions.
I'll take this one. I just completed a project that I'm excited to present at SGS pretty soon. So I guess depending on when this comes out, I don't know how much into the details I can get here. But I recently carried out a life cycle assessment of eater and manipulators. And for those of you who've not heard that term before, life cycle assessment, that is essentially a cradle to grave approach where you're looking at a product or process all the way from the production, which could mean extraction of those materials to build that, all the way to production, manufacturing, the use cycle. If, for example, if you're using a bipolar energy device and you're plugged into the wall, you're taking energy, electricity, all the way to disposal, if the sterilization's involved or not, et cetera. So to carry out this type of work, though, it is a lot of work, as Amy has just mentioned. So for example, you have to understand the sterilization process. And for those of you who haven't really thought about it, you're like, oh yeah, it goes in the autoclave. No, it does not just go into the autoclave. For example, if we're looking at a manipulator that has used in the operating room, that's a reusable manipulator, like the Pelosi. Many of us, I think, listening to this very much miss the Pelosi, very, very much. And that was a totally stainless steel manipulator. But basically, you know, the items are sprayed down with a detergent in the operating room, and then they go down to central sterilization where all of the instruments in your trays get a hand scrub. Like, if they're not very bloody or messy or any other bio burden on them, it'll be a quick scrub, but basically everything gets a quick hand wash and then before it goes to the next step. And so in the operating room, yes, we don't want to be using too much water. However, some water on the field is good because it's going to minimize the bio burden on your instruments. You don't want to have too bloody instruments because then that's less work later on, you know, when the hand scrubbing station. So back to the scrub sink. After that, then the items go into a washing machine for a cycle, maybe an hour long, maybe less than that, maybe more than that, depends on your cycle. And then after that, the items are placed in their trays to be sterilized again in the autoclave. And that cycle can take maybe an hour or so, more or less, time to like heat up, cool down, et cetera. And then after that, they're ready to go to be reused. So that's, for example, what happens to a device. And finding out all of that information took a lot of phone calls, a lot of meetings, going down to central sterilization, meeting the leader down there who walked me through this whole process. And then after that, we asked, okay, so how much soap are we using? So truly, to figure out the data that we're talking about, like how much soap, how many grams of soap were we using for that washing your the tray of instruments? How many trays go with one bit of soap? Down to how many items are in the tray? How long does that take? What is the labor? And then if you're doing a cost analysis as well, which we did, okay, well, how long does it take for these trays? How many trays do they do in an hour? What is the breakdown, et cetera? To Amy's point, it was a lot of work, a lot of conversations, a lot of back and forth, a lot of patience to get all this information. Now, on the flip side, for single-use instruments, that is information that our industry colleagues do not want to share. Granted, sure, it's proprietary information, and I surely don't want to go out and make a plastic manipulator. Anybody listening who knows me knows that. However, it's hard to find, and so what a lot of us do in this field is we deconstruct instruments to their bases, and using expert knowledge, or there are other devices that you can use, but when you do this enough, you know what materials are made of, and then you weigh them, you quantify the devices, and then there's programs and software out there that say, okay, well, this is nylon, you know, this takes X amount, and it quantifies the amount of emissions to make the nylon, and we have 0.000 grams of nylon, you know, et cetera. And that's how we get our information. So it takes a lot of work, and this is hard work, and it takes, for some people, it is a full-time job. And when somebody recently emailed and said, hey, can you do this for my hospital? It's like, I'm so sorry, I cannot, because just doing a few different versions of one device took months and months and months and significant amount of time. With this work, I'm happy to share that, sure, the steel device, the reusable device, had the lowest carbon footprint. Probably not surprising to many. But the other important thing that I need to bring up, because it's one of the more important messages, is that many administrators will say, but what about the cost? but what about the cost of the labor to sterilize everything? Like, that's just so expensive compared to the plastic product that can be thrown away and doesn't need all this. In reality, when you're looking at the life cycle of a reusable device, like a reusable stainless steel device, many of those devices can be used hundreds and hundreds of times. One study quoted 300 times, but I will say that our Pelosi manipulators that we had at McGee Women's Hospital, where I did my training, those were used many more than 300 times. Like, Amy Park used them before I came along, and they're still being used, which just goes to show that, you know, you put a little bit of upfront cost and they can last a long time. And in reality, the labor, it pales in comparison when you were talking about 300 Pelosi's versus 300 disposable items. It doesn't add up. So it's a lot of work to learn this information, and we are going to carry out the same similar project for a specula. We know the life cycle analysis of specula, as Jane already told us, the plastic specula impacts are 4 times higher carbon footprint than stainless steel specula, but what about the cost? And so stay tuned, because hopefully in a few months we'll be able to share that data, and I suspect that the steel specula will be cheaper in the end.
And let me, I just want to add, if anyone is interested, I did take Columbia University's life cycle, an LCA boot camp, which is for healthcare providers. So if you're interested in learning about life cycle analysis, you want to do it at your institution, definitely check them out. It's a great course. And if you have basic questions, Allie and I are happy to answer basic questions, but we cannot do a life cycle analysis at your institution for you.
Correct. I wish, but we can't.
I have to say that the specula is such a hot topic, because every time this comes up at a meeting or whatever, everybody in the audience is like raising their hands and saying stuff like, Jayco came and said, it's actually not even Jayco, it's the fear of Jayco, okay? I've never heard a citation saying specula, okay? Like, thank God Allie came in the nick of time, because we're about to switch to plastic specula, apparently, unbeknownst to us.
No, please, God, no.
But like, so many places are going to do that because in the short term, they're thinking that it's cheaper and better. And it's actually, you know, we were talking about life cycle analysis, and it's a way more sophisticated scenario, but you have to bring the arguments forward and fight.
Right. Exactly. And a part of, you know, what we haven't mentioned yet is for the disposable devices, especially those are made of plastic. But studies have shown us that, you know, 95% of the environmental impacts are from the production phase. And that's part of the fact that many of them are plastic. And we already talked a lot about that. And so if we're the solution for that is that we don't use the plastic devices. Yes, every device on the market is going to have some emissions and impact from their production phase. We can't get around that. But when you're making the mass quantities of these single-use items, that's what adds up. And that's what can be hard to wrap your head around. I think that what's visible and what we all see in the operating rooms where many of us work is the red bags. We all talk about the red bag waste and that we shouldn't be putting everything in the red bags, and that's true. What should go in the regulated medical waste is items that are truly saturated in blood, as well as items that can theoretically cause infection. But really, it's the saturated in blood. But I know that at a previous institution, you know, when the case started, it was red bag waste, and that was it. Because if it touched the patient, it had to go in there, and that's not backed by evidence. And when you think about, you know, you're at home, like I have a toddler and we're still in diapers and there's potentially infectious, you know, waste. I'm like, you know what are in diapers? Like that's going in the municipal trash. And so like Foley catheter bags that have patient urine, like that does not need to go in red bag waste. But regardless, we see waste. We see waste. That is easy for us to wrap our head around. And that gets a lot of press. And it's like, well, let's do better recycling. But in reality, getting back to the scope 3 conversation that we started, in reality, we need to stop using so much of these products. We need to stop producing these products, and we need more reusable devices that we can use. There have been some studies that have come out that are some commentaries that are really saying that surgeries and operating rooms are playgrounds for innovation. We have made incredible things. Think about like the Da Vinci robot. Like that's a beautiful invention. Like it truly is. However, do we need to throw the arms away after 10 uses? Like, why is it 10 when, you know, when we're using them for practice, there's so many more uses? the trocars. It's really great that they stainless steel trocars. And I like that feature. But what about the trocar introducer? That's disposable. And so it's things like that. Those little things, those add up. And I know that for, you know, I do a lot of laparoscopy and all of my trocars right now are plastic and I hate that. And so, you know, I can only do so much. So I'm working on it. Believe me, I'm working on it. I don't think that we have any contracts right now, so bear with me. But that's another thing. When you think about all of the laparoscopic cases that go on in an institution and all of those trocars being thrown away. So that's where the innovation needs to happen. And, you know, we've been calling on our leaders in international and national to help us. And as physicians, we call on industry, help us. We want reusable devices. We need more of them. And that's where this needs to go. And while we know that it's not as financially beneficial for the company to be focusing more on reusable devices in the long term, there's always going to be OBGYN residents graduating every year who are going to want, you know, they're going to need items when they go to new institutions. So there's always going to be a market. Items over time, you know, they do break down and whatnot. But that is the big call here as well. And that's something that I'm trying to get more interested, not interested, but trying to get more involved in, is working with our industry partners to move the field in the direction that we need.
I will say the red bag waste, remind me again, I know it either has to be incinerated or like buried, right?
So it's really incinerated, or like they say incinerated or autoclaved.
Autoclaved, yeah.
So yeah. It's sterilized. It is taken off site. So if you have municipal waste versus red bag waste, the red bag waste is taken off site somewhere where it's incinerated or autoclaved prior to then going in the landfill where its final resting place is. And so for that process, that takes energy, that takes transportation. And for your institution, that takes money.
Yeah, it's 10 times the cost.
Exactly. And so 8 to 10 times the cost everywhere. And so, you know, you think that that doesn't add up, but it truly does add up versus just taking something to the landfill.
I saw this study in JAMA Surgery and they just did this quick little analysis. You guys need to be doing these studies in JAMA Surgery. It was like the impact of using reusable hats, you know, something we take for granted every day. And it was like, just because of the scale of it, all those little hats that we're using, I mean, like in an institution, we're probably using like 100 hats a day, right? Like at least. And then just doing that, we can really make a big impact. And that's not that big of a deal. I do use the booties, I have to say, just because I don't want my shoes to be all like gross.
And just wipe them off. It's okay. You need the plastic.
It's okay. I know. I should just wipe it off. You're right. But anyway, it's all these little things that like add up because of the scale of it. And I think some of the things that I've been listening to you guys and I follow what you're doing, it's just like, be mindful of what you're using. Try and use reusable, like uterine manipulators, reusable specula. Try and be mindful of these other things. I think, thank God, ACOG, like they retired our stance on reusable disposable instruments. Like I remember when that first started, I was like, oh my gosh, that's a problem with sterility. All the subsequent studies have shown no problems. I mean, because I truly, things like the ligature, they really are amazing. The bipolar and cutting technology, it is so amazing for laparoscopic cases. But I think that one way we can sort of mitigate the impact and the cost really is to reuse them if possible. And there's definitely lots of recycling programs, like huge recycling programs. And
absolutely.
Yeah, the concerns about sterility have never been borne out. Now there's big meta-analyses showing that there's no problems with them. And then some of the other things when I've heard you guys talk is just, well, I'm a big fan of the vaginal surgery. That's the OG single port.
It's true.
The OG single
minimally
port.
Invasive. Yes. OG minimally invasive.
OG minimally invasive modality, but it's a lot less instrumentation and reusables and disposables. So I do still love me a good vaginal case. Not to say that I don't do laparoscopic cases. And I think that that is a really big thing about partnering with industry, because innovation can't happen without smart people's ideas like yourselves at the table. And also we rely on them for innovation and rolling out to the market. But also we as surgeons and stakeholders have a lot of power by putting our dollars and our buying power towards companies who support those causes. And I think that's a circular, like virtuous cycle kind of. that I think people understand that, like companies understand that if it's important to the constituents, then they will try and do programs to do better.
Having said that, Allie, I'm doing phenomenal work. Amy, you as well, all of us doing our best to make a difference. But the fact is that we're little people in a really big system. And think for a second, what if the FDA required that there be a truthful statement of carbon emissions on every single product in the supply chain, right? Stat Health just ran an article a couple months ago saying, what if we were to try and make pharmaceuticals report the carbon emissions for their products? And we can't do that. No single individuals, no group of individuals can tell JCO and CMS and the FDA, hey, climate change is a thing. Hint, hint, it was the hottest year in 125,000 years. So maybe y'all need to get on board with this idea. But the fact of the matter is that we need people higher up to say, what? That's a really great idea. Give hospitals the opportunity to know and to choose which supplies come into their facility based on their carbon emissions. And if manufacturers were required to report, done and done, right? That would solve a huge part.
Well, at least there would be transparency. Yeah, like it would be like a nutritional label. So you kind of know like what you're getting.
How many calories, you know what I mean? Are in this? Yeah.
How many calories? This is like your carbon footprint. So I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's one of those things that, and thank God you guys are doing the work in this space. But, you know, I look in the mirror and I'm like, the problem is me, like that Taylor Swift song.
You know? Hi, it's me. The problem, it's me. I'm the problem, it's me. No, it's not.
It's like, but the thing is, like, what I have so much hope and faith in is that there are so many people out there who agree with us. Like, Sages retweeted and is like, there's like, UCSF is working on this. Like, our residents and fellows are really into it. Allie's going to work with our fellows on a project. Like, my former residents wrote a paper with us, and Cass Schwartz, she's at UCSF, is doing projects on this. Like, there's just a lot of interest in it. And I think that if we can just carry that momentum forward, I think there's just a lot of people who are seeing that this is a huge problem and we can impact and mitigate this in a significant way, you know? I mean, look at the Cleveland Clinic. It's a huge system.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. And, you know, studies have shown that when physicians bring their voices to this exact topic, those are the ones that are sitting at the table helping make decisions. The actions go so much further. For example, yes, Cleveland Clinic, there's a sustainability office, and we have a chief medical director of the sustainability, Dr. Alyssa Gordon. She's done incredible work in this field since 2009. And so, you know, when you have somebody leading who can blend the data that we have and bring together the administration piece as well as the clinical piece, you can go a lot farther. But to hit home a little bit more on what was already said, this is a systemic issue. Like, we were joking about, it's me, I'm the problem, it's me. But in reality, we're all individual people. But it's, as we said, you know, mass quantities, it's in bulk. That's what's making this hard. But we can't change it. One person can make a lot of change, but we need systems changes. We need FDA to make changes. We need the Joint Commission to make changes. There was such bad press last year for the Joint Commission, because I believe they tried to implement that we're going to also grade hospitals and health systems on their focus on sustainability in some respect. But then they retracted that and they said, no, it's more going to be like a extra credit type of thing. And those of us that are in the community, like, what is this? Like, we need you to put this forward, because just as we have put infection control at the forefront, that is what we need. And I'm going to give you a statistic here because it's pretty impactful. I think the year 2000 was when To Air Is Human came out, and we learned that 44 to 9,800,000 people die each year because of preventable medical errors. And if you translate that, it becomes like 440 to 980,000 life years lost. And data has come out showing that 470,000 disability adjusted life years are lost. And to health sector pollution, health damages. And so those numbers are fairly similar. And so our response should be proportional to the harm that we cause. And yeah, bodies like JCO and the FDA, EPA, you know, they can all stand up together.
HHS. It's just that,
yeah. Right. Oh, they're a huge part of this. There's people that we're all siloed. And so, you know, we're trying to put it all together, but it's systemic. It's us
people, individual surgeons, individual OBGYNs, individual doctors, as well as the systems that we work in.
Well, here's something. I just one last thing. I know we're wrapping up here, but if you were to ask Americans, have they heard about sustainable jet fuel? Chances are, not all, but some people have heard about sustainable jet fuel. Maybe they heard about the plane that flew across the Atlantic a couple of weeks ago on vegetable oil. Aviation only contributes 2.5%, not counting the contrails, but 2.5% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. We're at 10. How many U.S. healthcare CEOs are talking about what their healthcare system is doing in terms of addressing sustainability? I would say, Cleveland, you guys are a standout. Obviously, you guys get awards from Practice Greenhealth. You guys are amazing. I can't get my CEO to, I mean, there's a lot of CEOs who are like, yeah, thanks, no, okay, next. So there's a lot of leadership in aviation, which only contributes a tiny amount compared to U.S. healthcare. We need to get leadership on board. There needs to be peer pressure among hospital CEOs regarding their carbon footprints and their sustainability. Right now, it's not there. We need to push them. I go to my CMO's office and send him our articles. And I see him in the elevator. I'm like, hey, it's me.
Did you read that yet? Right.
Yeah. Well, so, you know what? I think it's important for enough people to come forward and say, this is important to me. And this is something, if you just do this, even just some work on the edges and demand it from stakeholders, I think people get it and are willing to listen. But if there's no reason or agency to change, then they won't change because inertia is for real. But I really, really applaud all of your efforts in this space. And I just am so inspired by all the work that you do. And I think just by like talking about it, getting people, and actually what I also am so inspired by is that the residents and the fellows and our trainees are really listening. Like there's a med student group. They introduced, remember the person, the medical student came up to us at ACOG and she had founded a group.
Medical Students for Sustainable Future.
Yes, exactly. So I think that there's lots of hope out there and we're just idealists. So, and that's what brought us to medicine. And so I think by just continuing that idealism, yeah, sometimes I'm cynical, but I really do believe in our power to affect positive change. I don't want to lose that about myself. So I'm continuing to be inspired by all the good work that you're doing. So thank you so much. And again, how should we reach out if people have questions or want to talk to you, like through the website, or how's the best way? Tweet at you, DM?
I feel like for Jane, I feel like your Twitter following is exceptional. But absolutely, I think that our, you know, the website, obg4sf.org, we keep it updated with our upcoming webinar, with opportunities, and we put literature specific to OBGYN. And so things, for example, climate papers that come out about the health effects of climate change that goes there, stuff that goes on there is like the speculative study, you can find them there. So, and then also links to other resources like Practice Green Health and Healthcare Without Harm. These are, you know, national and international organizations that have been working on this for decades, honestly. And just if you're thinking, where do I start? How do I get some more information? Those are some great places. But otherwise, if you reach out to us on our website, we'll get an email and you can get in touch with us.
Yeah, and it's so important to get a broad coalition because just the anesthetic gases, substituting one for the other and having an anesthesia champion, having champions in each department or institute in our case, because I think it's easier to people who really want to listen to an OBGYN lecture you if you're a urologist or ENT. It really helps to have someone in the fold who really understands what you're doing and can speak to what you're doing to talk. And so I'm hoping not only that we can talk about our field, but like across surgery, across healthcare, it's really important.
And as one of my closing thoughts, I just like to put a push for either making a change, a commitment to a change in one surgery. For example, we made a change in the way we conducted slings and observing how we were carrying out our sling cases. That was my first project. And by constantly educating those that were in our operating room and like educating and talking about and pointing out the trash and that the sterile blue towels don't need to go in the trash, it can be laundered. So many more people like learned from just us doing it with this case every time. And they took it to other services, like especially going back to trainees, like the trainees took it to other services and they even took it to other specialties. And then we did this again with our cystoscopy cases. We minimized the equipment that we were using. And I had residents coming back saying, oh, we did this in ONC and oh, we did this in our benign gyne cases that weren't urogyn cases. So committing, you know, if you're thinking, what can I do? Just start small, you know, start small, low hanging fruit, minimize something in your own operating room. And do it every time. And you may be pleasantly surprised by what other people see you doing and that they're going to start doing that elsewhere. And that is how we can make an impact.
That's awesome. Well, thank you guys so, so much for coming tonight. I really appreciate you sharing your insights. Again, inspirational work. Keep up the good work. And yeah, we look forward to hearing more from you on this topic in the future.
Thank you so much, Amy.
Sounds good. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you so much for listening. If you haven't already, make sure to follow the podcast, rate it 5 stars, and share with a friend. If you have any questions or comments, direct message us at _backtableobgyn on Instagram, Twitter, or LinkedIn. Backtable OBGYN is hosted by myself, Mark Hoffman,
and Amy Park.
Our audio team is led by Kieran Gannon, with support from
Josh McWhirter,
Aaron Bowles, Nick Shellcross,
Josh Spencer.
Design and digital marketing led by Brian Schmitz, with support from
Taylor's Version Hess and Yvonne Ovijinsky.
Show notes and social media by
Emma Landenwich
and Lindsay Beecham.
Administrative support provided by Jamila Kennebrew.
Music written and performed by Scott Baby Daddy Hoffman.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next time. The views and opinions expressed by the hosts and guests on Backtable OBGYN are their own and do not reflect the views or positions of their employers or any entities they represent.